America's preoccupation with Black Friday shopping craziness may be weakening. According to a Bankrate.com survey released yesterday, only 28% of shoppers plan to shop next Friday, although 40% plan to shop when you add online shopping into that data. Bankrate surveyed 1,000 adults, according to USA Today. As you're probably aware, more big retailers are planning to open on Thanksgiving this year. And a professor at Yale School of Management says the trend is creating more indifference because it seems like it's just going to stretch on. That's a quote from Professor Ravi Dhar. Coming up on Current State, the incomparable Stevie Wonder performs every song on his Songs in the Key of Life album. Tonight at the Palace of Auburn Hills, we'll talk with the Detroit News' Susan Whitehall about the concert and the album. Lots more planned before the end of the hour as well. To start off the program, the Lansing area, like much of Michigan, has been shaped by manufacturing. But the industry has taken a beating in the past 13 years. The state has lost hundreds of thousands of manufacturing jobs since 2001. After years of cuts, though, the industry is making a comeback here in mid-Michigan. GM plans to expand its Delta Township factory and build a brand new $174 million stamping plant near its Grand River Assembly Complex. The Canadian auto supplier Magna also has plans to build a new plant and expand its existing one. Those projects alone are expected to add hundreds of new jobs. But will workers have the skills to fill those positions? Many companies say there's a gap between the kinds of jobs available in manufacturing today and the experience and education of job seekers. They say that's led to unfilled positions and stunted economic growth. Bridging that gap is the goal of a jobs fair put on by Capital Area Michigan Works today and tomorrow. Here to talk about the importance of workforce development for mid-Michigan's manufacturing industry, Edie Hatter-Williams, CEO of Capital Area Michigan Works, and Michelle Cordano, Executive Director of the Capital Area Manufacturers Council. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Michelle, I mentioned that the manufacturing industry has really changed in the past 13 years. We've all heard of the lost decade here in Michigan. How different is it here in mid-Michigan today than it was, let's say, 20 years ago?
Well, manufacturing has evolved in many different ways over the last 13 years. You know, the recession was very tough, 08, 09, on many of the manufacturers, but the manufacturers that survived have diversified. They're leaner, they're cleaner, they're stronger, they're more high-tech, more advanced than they used to be. And like you said, manufacturing is back. Just in the last few years, we have added 90,000 jobs in Michigan back in manufacturing. Over the next 6 months to a year, we're expecting over 1,000 jobs just to the mid-Michigan region. Mm. So manufacturing is back and stronger than ever.
Edie, we hear a lot of discussion about the skills gap, though. Can you explain to us what that means?
Well, what that is that we have unemployed individuals that either have no manufacturing experience or maybe have worked for a manufacturer and has been laid off. But when they went to work, maybe they didn't have to have a high school diploma or a GED even. And so now, in order to apply for these new manufacturing jobs, you've got to have a high school diploma, GED, and in many cases, additional training. And so, first of all, getting those individuals that don't have the bare minimums to get them to get a, at this point, it would be a GED, is certainly can be daunting for somebody that is now maybe in their 40s or 50s that is not ready to retire, needs to work, but is having trouble maneuvering the educational system to get the minimums. And then, of course, they have to have that before they can get additional training. And then you've got those that maybe have the high school diploma, GED, but still need to go back and get some additional training that, for whatever reason, they opt not to want to do that. And so we've got to figure out how to either encourage them to do that or start looking at our young people encouraging them to not drop out, to stay in school, and to get the additional training that's needed to be able to fill the jobs the manufacturers are needing.
And what kinds of jobs are companies looking to fill? Which kinds of jobs are going unfilled?
Well, there are lots of different jobs in manufacturing, and I talk a lot about this. We definitely have a need for machinists. We have a need for just production operators. We have a need for CNC and also for engineers, especially industrial engineers. But overall, as manufacturing grows at the rate that it's growing, we also need jobs like HR professionals, we need accountants, we need salespeople. So lots of different job opportunities in manufacturing, especially with this large amount of growth.
The manufacturing jobs, are they mostly entry level or are they more advanced positions?
It's really a mix. We definitely have some entry-level jobs that, and we encourage those job seekers out there to come to the event today and tomorrow, even if they don't have any manufacturing experience. There are many jobs that if you have the aptitude and if you have the desire, you can actually be trained on the job to perform many of the jobs that are available. And then there's also going to be five different short-term training programs presented by Lansing Community College, which will help folks who want maybe a little bit higher-paying job and can fill some of these middle-skill jobs like welders and CNC machinists.
Michelle Cordano is Executive Director of the Capital Area Manufacturers Council. We're also joined by Edie Hatter-Williams, CEO of Capital Area Michigan Works. We're talking about manufacturing here in the Lansing area and mid-Michigan and the number of jobs that are going unfilled due to an alleged skills gap. What do you think contributes to this mismatch between the jobs available and the skills of job seekers? Are people not thinking in terms of manufacturing jobs anymore?
Yes, I mean, I think, one of the things is manufacturing has a bad rap. 08-09 was really hard on many of the families and the communities in Michigan. And I think that's part of our job as workforce development professionals is to get the word out that manufacturing is back, that manufacturers offer good pay, they offer clean, safe environments, and that we are hiring. And the trend is expected to continue. Just some statistics from our local people, Department of Labor, manufacturing is going to continue to grow and offer a large number of annual openings across the variety of low, mid, and high-skilled jobs, both over the short and long term. So manufacturing is back.
I'm under the impression, though, that when you look at this thing from 10 miles up, manufacturing across the country, for example, is actually shrinking. But one of the contributing factors as well is that there's a demographic dynamic in play here. There's a lot more people retiring. There's a lot more people my age who are getting out, who are retiring, and there simply are not enough people to take the place of the people who are retiring. Is that in play here too?
I think so. When I was growing up, there were all types of apprenticeship programs that were between with the manufacturers. There were co-op opportunities between the schools and the companies, and a lot of that seemed to go away. I mean, I think there are very few manufacturers that even offer those type of experiences. And so when those were alive and well, you had that pipeline. You had students were learning about manufacturers. They were working there, whether it, work experiences or internships or apprenticeships. They were learning the trades of the company. And then when they graduated from high school, they were hired by that company, and which went on to make a good living for themselves. But we don't have a lot of that. And I think part of that was probably even before the recession. And so I think businesses have to start now thinking ahead and maybe moving back towards that model so that they do have a pipeline of individuals coming out of the high schools that are going to stay in the community, going to raise families here to help offset some of the issues that they're having with talent.
What role does education play in this, though?
I think it plays a huge role. Just recently on National Manufacturers Day, we took a group of high school counselors and STEM teachers on a tour of 3 manufacturing facilities. And, you know, those counselors and those STEM teachers are a crucial part of building our workforce for manufacturing. We have vocational education available for many of the students in our area. And we want to get the word out that that there are pathways for kids in high school, whether they do vocational education or co-ops or internships, to get out into the community and see what the opportunities are, as well as our community colleges. LCC offers some great programs as well.
There's a lot of focus on getting kids into 4-year colleges these days. Do you think that contributes to young people not applying for these jobs?
Yes.
They're looking,
yes. We're gonna, both going to say
they're
yes.
They're looking at each other, but you
yes.
agree the answer is yes.
Well, I think because the push is, you know, parents, I think just by nature, want their kids to go to college. But everybody does not want to go. And even if they do go, it's okay to go later. And I'll probably get in trouble for saying that, but I think we have to push the importance of not just college, but there are very good jobs with just a little bit of training out of high school. You can come out and make a decent wage. And not only that, I mean, I don't know about you, but the last time I had a plumber come to my house, I certainly had to pay them more for that less than an hour that they were there than I make hour.
So. I've had this discussion with dozens of people, you know, refrigerator repair people, and you know, plumbers, everything like that.
So those trades, I mean, they do pay very well, and you don't have to have a bachelor's degree to enter into that. It does require additional training, and but you can make very good money without having a degree.
How do people take that first step, though? How does someone, say, in their 40s, take that first step to getting into manufacturing who may not have any? Is Lansing Community College? Would you recommend that option? Would you recommend that a applicant make it clear to General Motors, hey, I'm open to further training here? Is that
well,
how this unfolds?
You know, for today, I would say come on down today. Register for our event today or tomorrow, because we're going to have all the information nicely packaged for everyone. It's going to talk about the jobs that are available, how to get them. We're also going to talk about working on your resume and mock interviews. So the Capillary Michigan Works is a great resource for individuals, and that's where I would direct somebody, you know, in their 40s, somebody who's looking for a job, maybe somebody who's looking to move into the manufacturing industry who has not before. It's a great resource, and today we're going to have many of the local resources all in one room and available to talk to job seekers.
Our guests here are Michelle Cordano, Executive Director of the Capital Area Manufacturing Council, along with Edie Hatter-Williams, CEO of Capital Area Michigan Works. Is all manufacturing these days advanced manufacturing?
No, not all of it. I mean, you still have the whole chain of manufacturing, you know, starting out with your raw materials at the very, very beginning, you know, and moving through fabrication and sequencing and, you know, tool and die and molding, you know, all the way up to, you know, like a GM where you're actually assembling, putting all the parts together and creating the final product. So there are different levels of manufacturing, but there is quite a bit of advanced manufacturing going on currently. And it's not all related to the auto industry. I think that's important, mm-hmm. too. We also have, you know, we have Emergent BioSolutions in the area, you know, who is making the vaccine for anthrax. We have NioWave, who is working with superconducting electrons, and they have applications in military, and they have applications in medical, in the medical field. We have medical manufacturers actually making parts that go into your body, hip bones and spines and
it's
things
amazing.
Like that. So manufacturing is much bigger and much more advanced.
Again, the basics, Edie, on the job sphere. It happens today and tomorrow at the Cedar Street location of Capital Area Michigan Works?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Very good. And your website, if people want to learn more?
Our website is www.camw.org.
Well, there you go. Michelle Cordano is with the executive director with the Capital Area Manufacturing Council. Also, thank you to Edie Hatter-Williams, CEO of Capital Area Michigan Works. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And speaking of manufacturing, Cadillac has unveiled the next model that General Motors will build here in Lansing. Current State Scott Pohl is here with a look at the ATS-V. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mark. We do have a manufacturing theme today, don't we?
Right. We absolutely do.
Well, GM is showing off the new ATS-V at the Los Angeles Auto Show this week. I talked with Tony Roma, the chief engineer on the project. The ATS-V will be built at Lansing's Grand River Assembly Plant. Roma calls it Cadillac's first entry into the compact luxury performance car market.
This is the tip of the spear, the performance variant, twin turbo V6 versus the V8s we've done in the past, MR dampers, we've got an electronically adjustable limited slip differential, electric power steering. So that's the car in a nutshell.
Who's your target market for this new model?
Yeah, our target market is basically buyers that have purchased cars like the BMW M3 or the AMG version of the C-Class Mercedes or like an RS4 Audi. So it's the customer who's probably a little bit more performance-minded, maybe takes their car to the track occasionally or might think about wanting to do that at some point if they haven't before. But that's our market, a little younger. It's a lighter, more nimble car with the emphasis more on the athleticism.
What's the 0 to 60 going to be?
Yeah, this car will do 0 to 60 in 3.9 seconds. Top speed is 189 miles per hour.
It will be built in Lansing. Can you give me some details about its construction in Lansing when the time comes?
Yeah, we're already starting to build the early units. The car goes into production this spring. So, yeah, it's got a host of new things, new challenges for my partners over at LGR. The car's got a carbon fiber hood. Post some new challenges. We've never done that before. There's other things, carbon fiber splitter, pretty aggressive rear spoiler, some specific things to the front fender. It's all new. So there was a lot of work for the guys at LGR to get ready to build this car, and they've done a great job.
Can you tell me anything about how many units might be planned for, say, the first year?
Yeah, we're not specifically talking about volume. I can tell you we'll sell as many as we build. We're keeping our volume expectations realistic. This is a fairly expensive car, and it's a fairly unique buyer. This isn't really intended to be a mass market car. So we're not talking about volumes, but I think we'll probably sell about two-thirds of them in the coupe version and about one-third sedan.
And I understand the price range is going to be in the $60,000 range. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to be competitive with the other entries. We haven't announced our specific pricing, but that's a fair guess.
Now, you mentioned a few of the new features on the vehicle, or at least some of the challenges that will be faced by the UAW workers in Lansing who will be building it. What will some of those features mean to a prospective buyer?
Well, the things like the carbon fiber hood, the weight of a performance car especially is important, and then the hood is one of those things where it's high up on the car above the center of gravity and very far forward. So we want to keep the car as close to a 50-50 weight ratio as possible. So I know we've asked our partners in Lansing for that challenge, but it's a real benefit to the customer. And then there's other things that we've done to enhance the structural stiffness of the car. There's a big shear panel that goes on the bottom to stiffen up all the suspension nodes, which doesn't exactly lend itself to easily being manufactured. But it results in better steering response, better structural feel, that feeling of the car being machined from billet, things like that, that we've added some mass, so you pay a mass penalty for that. You got to save weight other places like the hood. So I could keep going on and on. There's lots of technology in the car like that.
We're talking with Tony Roma, the chief engineer on the ATS with the Cadillac division of General Motors. And I wonder about electronic features in the vehicle and the dashboard display and so on. Anything new there in this new model?
The car's got a performance data recorder that has a forward-facing camera that'll record what the car is doing and overlay interesting statistics, you know, lateral G-forces, speed, engine speed. And it builds in a lap timer if you're out on a track. We've got the MR dampers, which are infinitely adjustable shocks. We've got 4G Wi-Fi built into the car. That's built into all the ATSs started in 2015. We've got an electronically controlled limited slip differential, GM's brand new 8-speed automatic transmission. I can keep going on and on.
Would I be correct that people will be able to see the ATS-V at the North American International Auto Show in Detroit?
Yep, absolutely. We unveiled the car last night. We had a little gathering after hours, and the car's here on the floor today in L.A., and it'll be there when we get to Detroit, too.
Well, I'm grateful for your time, Tony. Thank you so much.
Oh, no problem.
Tony Roma is chief engineer on Cadillac's ATS-V project. He spoke with us from the Los Angeles Auto Show. For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. Tonight, a Michigan-born superstar returns home to perform a legendary album.
Been spending most of their lives living in a pastime paradise. Been spending most of their lives.
Pastime paradise there from Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life. Through the years, only a few pop albums have enjoyed its acclaim. The double, actually triple, record package won 3 Grammys, including Album of the Year in 1977. Tonight at the Palace of Auburn Hills, Stevie Wonder will perform all the tracks on the album. Sir Duke, Isn't She Lovely, Love's in Need of Love Today, and 18 others. Detroit News music writer Susan Whitehall recently spoke with Stevie Wonder about his Songs in the Key of Life tour and the album and other things. Welcome, Susan.
Oh, thank you.
Greetings from your alma mater here in East Lansing.
Absolutely.
Why did Stevie Wonder decide to perform this album, Songs in the Key of Life?
Well, he said he'd been wanting to do it for a while. Actually, ever since the album came out, he thought it would be a good idea. And he just did it for a charity last winter, for this toy charity for kids that he does in Los Angeles. And it came off really well, so they thought it would be a natural.
And
he's done Greatest Hits tours the last few times out, too. So.
And he performs every track on the album. This is a 3-record set, really, strictly speaking.
Two albums and then the EP, the extended play,
yeah,
which I lost long ago, of course.
I think a lot of people did. Stevie has said he thinks it's probably his best album, and I imagine millions of his fans probably agree with that, but it's a hard choice. To you, Susan, what makes the album so special?
Well, I think the huge diversity of sound on there, the different styles. You've got the classical, you just heard the... what you just played, there's fugues on there. He's playing on the synthesizer. There's the jazz of Sir Duke. There's, contusion, sounds like Weather Report. Then he's got funk. He's got soul. It's just extremely diverse. And at the time it came out, people thought it was almost too diverse and a little too lengthy. I think the critics kind of softened their view on that. I know that the public certainly loved it from the first.
You spoke with Stevie Wonder when he had done, I think, a couple of performances. It was early in the tour when you spoke with him. Did he have anything to say on the experience at that point?
Actually, he hadn't started yet.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
Yeah, but he was, he's always supremely confident. That's one of the charms about Stevie. He knows what he's doing. It's like when I was asking him about when Motown almost dropped him years ago, and it was true. He said it never bothered him. He never thought about it because he's confident because he's got this music inside him. He writes it, he performs it, he knows exactly what every instrument should be playing on stage. And
he plays most of them.
Yeah, exactly. And you can't take that away from him. He's like a self-contained unit. So on stage, he's been back touring now for several years. Since when his mother died, he went back on the road. And he's a well-honed machine, put it that way. I can say, of all the Motown acts I've seen, he comes the closest in concert to reproducing the Motown sound, that big band. He's brilliant at that.
Susan Whitehall is our guest, music writer for the Detroit News. We're talking about tonight's performance by Stevie Wonder at the Palace of Auburn Hills. He'll perform every track on his 1976 album, Songs in the Key of Life. You mentioned As a minute ago, which is one of the really powerhouse tracks on this album. And I understand that during your interview with Stevie, he got a bit emotional talking about that track. Apparently, it was his mother's favorite song of his. And you focused on that song with Stevie. What did he say about it?
Well, he was saying, yeah, he said that he actually sang that at his mother's funeral and that it was emotional for him to do that. That was her favorite song. And even though I think it was 2006 that she died, 2007, he still gets very emotional about that. That was a big, big loss to him. I mean, she was a single mom, and she was his whole world growing up in Detroit, very important to him. You know, she has there's a brief appearance of her in the Motown musical that's sort of comical when she brings little Stevie out. She's very, very protective, and she drove a hard bargain with Berry Gordy. That's what the scene entails.
How about that? Our listeners who remember little Stevie Wonder might be surprised to learn that Stevie Wonder today is 64 years old. What is his life like these days?
Well, he's got, in the past year or two, he's had a new girlfriend and a new baby, and she's expecting another. It's due in December sometime. I believe that brings his, he's 10 or 11 kids. So he's as always, music consumes him. He does it every day. I was asking him how he keeps his chops up on the harmonica, and he plays it every day.
How about that?
But he would do that no matter what. He plays and listens to music every day because he loves it.
Mm. You also got Stevie Wonder to write the introduction to your book, Fever. This was your biography of singer Little Willie John. Remind our listeners who Little Willie John was and his connection to Stevie Wonder.
Well, Little Willie John was a great R&B singer from Detroit, went to Pershing High and everything, and he did the original version of the song Fever that Peggy Lee covered later. So Stevie grew up listening to him on the radio, hearing his songs. Talk to Me was another hit, and he loved them. Well, years later, he met Keith John and Kevin John, Willie's sons, and he's been Keith John has been his backup singer for 25 years now. You'll see him in concert at the Palace, and Keith is the one who got Stevie to write that intro for us. He didn't write it; he spoke it. Keith got him backstage and said, okay, talk about my dad and his influence on you. So people know Stevie, but they don't necessarily know where his influences came from, except for some of the obvious ones like Ray Charles and, you know, things like that. So I think if you listen to Willie's vocals, you can hear a lot of what came out in Stevie later on, which is really fascinating. And the song Superstition actually was influenced by a Little Willie John song, Leave My Kitten Alone.
Our guest is Susan Whitehall of the Detroit News. We're talking about Stevie Wonder and his album Songs in the Key of Life, which Stevie Wonder will perform tonight live at the Palace of Auburn Hills. Prior to coming to the Detroit News, you spent almost 8 years at Detroit's legendary rock magazine Cream with Lester Bangs and some other pretty established rock writers. Share your best Cream magazine story with us, if you will.
Oh, gosh, probably, you know, I was right out of Michigan State, of course, English degree. What are you going to do? So I did luck out with that job, I would say. So I always tell people, hey, go ahead and major in English. What the heck? I think Lester took me to my first ever party as a staffer. It ended up, we were backstage at Rod Stewart and the Faces. They said, hey, you want to go to a party at David Ruffin's house with the Temptations? I'm like, you were like, yeah, okay.
I guess so.
Bobby Womack got in our car, the famous R&B singer, and he showed us the way. And it was an extremely elegant party, just fantastic. Ruffin was a great host, and we ended up in a back room singing. Here I am singing with David Ruffin.
Good grief.
And Lester and Ron Wood of the Faces then. He's with the Stones now. He was playing guitar. You know, it's like, oh, my gosh. And to Lester, it was just another night out, as I was defined.
And so that was your first of 8 years' worth of parties at Cream Magazine. So you got off to a bang of a start there.
Oh, yeah.
I take it you'll be attending the concert tonight.
Oh, absolutely. I'll be reviewing, yeah.
How many times have you seen Stevie Wonder in concert?
You know, he hasn't toured as much as some people, but I don't know. I think it's less than 10 times.
That's still pretty good, Susan.
Yeah.
We want to...
He was, and I told him this, my mother bought me my first 45 ever, which is a single to everybody younger, the Little Records. That was his fingertips.
Oh, perfect.
Single.
Perfect.
Yeah.
We got to leave it there. Detroit News music writer Susan Whitehall recently covered Stevie Wonder, interviewed Stevie Wonder, and tonight he performs all of the songs on Songs in the Key of Life at the Palace of Auburn Hills. Thank you, Susan. Have fun tonight.
Thank you. Go green.
Coming up on Current State, a leading nonpartisan Michigan think tank is recommending state lawmakers invest more in early childhood education and child care. Bob Schneider of the Citizens Research Council of Michigan explains, and a Michigan rocketry club plans to blast a porta potty into the lower atmosphere Saturday. Current State tries to find the why coming up.
Hello again, I'm Armin Alney. On the next To The Point, as more Americans have been captured and executed by terrorists overseas, the Obama administration is reviewing its hostage policy. Paying ransom is not considered an option, but the families of hostages are demanding more back-channel diplomacy to bring their loved ones back alive. That's next time on To The Point from Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 on AM 870 WKAR.
Amnesty by executive order. Other presidents have done it. Now it's this president's turn.
I prefer and still prefer to see it done through Congress, but every day that I wait, we're deporting people that shouldn't be deported. We're not deporting folks that are dangerous and need to be deported.
President Obama gets ready to roll out with his announcement in Vegas. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at 3 on AM 870 WKAR.
Current State, Mid-Michigan's meeting place for the informed, the caring, and the curious. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Michigan legislature formally reconvenes on December 2nd when lawmakers return for a three-week lame duck session. In the meantime, the Citizens Research Council of Michigan has been thinking about what it believes should be the state's next major investment strategy. The CRC has released a new report outlining several policy recommendations to support at-risk children from birth to age 3. Recently, I spoke with Bob Schneider, the Director of State Affairs for the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. He says his agency wanted to get a handle on how many children in the state could benefit from expanded services in their first crucial years of life.
You know, it's a very important issue. It's one that I think is being recognized more and more as a critical issue. Lots of scientific research on brain development in the critical early years, particularly those first 3 years of a child's life, where their interactions with good, strong, you know, nurturing adults is very important. We wanted to help legislators and policymakers measure the need, how many kids might be out there in Michigan, age 0 to 3, that are at risk, and then, you know, what are the next steps that we can take to help them address some of the challenges they're facing?
How do you define at risk?
We looked at several factors. Low-income children that struggle in low-income households, developmentally disabled children, children with parents with low educational attainment, which we defined as less than a high school diploma in the households. We looked at children that have been exposed to severely adverse situations. Often in the literature, they talk about toxic stress, death of a parent, divorce, exposure to as a victim or a witness to violence in the home. And our key goal was what factors contribute to children falling behind and not being ready for school when they hit the front door of the school when they turn 5 years old.
How many Michigan kids are in that category?
Our estimates are about 260,000 kids aged 0 to 3 in Michigan. That's out of about 465,000. It's about 55%+ of that population, better than 1 in 2, have faced at least one of those factors that we just talked about in Michigan. So that's a very sizable number, and that's why we, that next part of the report is, all right, we have this many kids in the state that may be facing challenges. What can we do to help them be better ready for school and better ready for further development in life?
Your report focuses on four areas in which the CRC is encouraging the state to invest. Let's look first at expanding home visiting programs, which your group identifies as its top recommendation. There are agencies now that do home visits for young kids. What stands to be improved?
It's not as much an improvement as probably an expansion of what's out there now. And I should clarify, home visiting is pairing a trained service provider, probably a nurse or a social worker, with the family to help them deal with challenges they face. They may have a child in the home with a specific health condition, asthma, for instance, help a family where there might be a red flag for some type of abuse and neglect, potential abuse and neglect in the home. The federal government has made some significant investments, and Michigan's received some grant funding in this area to expand home visiting around the state. That's happening right now as we speak. And there are four models in Michigan right now that qualify as federally evidence-based models. And our report is encouraging, where we have money now on the table, let's further expand these models throughout the state so that more children get the benefit from these evidence-based programs. So, the research that we looked at was reviewed in our report, and it was pretty unequivocal in terms of, these programs are working. They're having impacts on these young children.
Our guest is Bob Schneider here on Current State. Bob is Director of State Affairs for the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. We've been talking about a new report that outlines a series of policy options the CRC is recommending to the legislature to support children from birth to age 3. What about the parents here, Bob? Their life situations contribute to their kids' development. What should be available to them as well?
Well, we just talked about the home visiting. That will, one of the critical pieces of home visiting
is
helping those parents, is engaging those parents, too, in home visiting. Childcare is another area that we looked at in our report. In Michigan, we have had a significant drop-off in spending on childcare subsidies, and we know there's research that's documented childcare costs nationally and in Michigan have gone up significantly over the last couple decades. So another focus of our report is reinvesting in our state's childcare program to help parents who need to work have access to a high-quality childcare, and that's one very interesting focus of the research. Is for a long time there was the thought that we needed babysitters, but the level of care wasn't all that important. More recent research, as they've analyzed the type of child care environment, has started to change that conclusion a little bit. High quality care can have very very positive impacts on children. Michigan has a system in place now called Great Start to Quality. It's a system that will allow child care providers to get a rating, a star-based rating, 2 stars, 4 stars, 5 stars, based on quality, hopefully to be a guide then to parents and caretakers to get kids into high-quality care. And that program is on the ground now. And our suggestion is, let's validate that rating system first and then try to use that system to target dollars to high quality care where we can see that care is having a real bang for the buck for kids.
What standards comprise what you would describe as quality child care?
Well, I think a key is the positive interactions between the child care provider and
one-on-one.
Close contact. Michigan's quality system looks at various factors. Staffing ratios, curriculum are some of them, but the empirical research that's looked at that has used some classroom assessment tools to try to evaluate what's the quality of the interaction going on in this room right now between the staff and the children in care, and that's critical.
There was a blistering state audit issued in July of 2008 that criticized the Michigan Department of Human Services for doing a poor job screening out unsuitable child care providers. The state was subsidizing child daycare, and the audit took a stern look at who was being paid for services. Some changes were made, but it resulted in more bureaucracy that has since caused many providers to drop out. How has that translated into the state's spending for child care?
It's dropped significantly. And that audit was focused on sort of payment integrity, that it wasn't clear, at least, and there were some suggestions that there were mispayments, that provider A was getting paid but hadn't actually provided services for the child. And there were probably some very legitimate concerns that were raised in the audit. But the response to it was to set up a pretty elaborate system of checks and balances where providers would have to report hourly time assessments. Johnny was here from 2 to 5 on Monday and 1 to 5 on Wednesday. The parent would have to also report, well, my child was in care during these hours. They'd get matched, and then red flags would get thrown if those didn't match up exactly. And I think the end result was a lot of providers said, I can't do this.
More bureaucracy than I can handle.
And so you saw we spent over $400 million on child care subsidies in Michigan in fiscal year 2007. By fiscal year 2013, we spent $135 million. Still a lot of money, but it's about a 67% decline in spending in this area. Now, some of that probably was eliminating some, mispayments that may have been occurring at that time that the audit focused. But I believe some of this has been providers and potentially parents as well saying, I don't want to jump through all these extra hoops. Mm-hmm. So we're suggesting if we're going to make this reinvestment, let's try to focus that money on high quality care environments that have shown in the research that they're going to have a return on investment benefits for that child down the road that persist.
We're talking with Bob Schneider, Director of State Affairs for the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. Let's talk for a minute about the health needs of young kids. There's a concept called a medical home, which basically means ensuring kids have a primary care physician they can see on a regular basis. But your report goes a step further and talks about a team approach. Can you explain what that's about?
Yes, absolutely. So there's wide recognition of the need for medical homes for everyone, but especially for young children. And most of us think of that. We have a primary care physician. That primary care physician helps coordinate our care. If we need to see a specialist, we can get a referral. But for at-risk families, there are a couple layers that could be added on to that. First, how do we support parents? They're the first level healthcare providers for their children. What can we do to help them become better, first responders, basically, for healthcare needs for their child? And then how do we support both families and providers in enhancing the medical home relationship? That's not only access then to a high care provider, medical provider, doctor, but what about transportation needs? I can't get my child to my medical appointment because I don't have a vehicle, or I can't get access to public transit. Language needs. If I only speak Spanish, a parent, I need to be able to converse with the staff. In Kent County in 2008, they adopted a Children's Healthcare Access Program called CHAP. The acronym. It's a partnership between their Medicaid health plans in that area, local medical providers, and other local agencies that participated. And they have sort of a central team, nurse, social workers, community health workers, that act to provide wraparound services, basically, to these families. Referrals to community services, transportation, other community services as needed. Follow-up calls. Jimmy missed his appointment. You get a call to just prompt, that well care visit's very important. Mm-hmm. How can we make that work for you? What barrier did you face maybe that prevented you from being able to get into the office? In the financials that we looked at on this in Kent County suggest that the program for each child that received these wraparound services, there were many children that are Medicaid eligible that fall under the program, but there were I think the number was 2,000 children that actually received direct services from this team at a cost of $224 per child. And if you extrapolate from that, and how much would it take statewide then to cover all Medicaid-eligible children in a similar type of program? Mm-hmm. It comes to about $10 million. That's a lot of money, but in the big picture of the state budget, that's a doable number. So we're recommending, as policymakers look at medical home as an issue, an effective option for them would be let's look to expand this type of wraparound program mm-hmm. that can help.
Bob Schneider, Director of State Affairs for the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. We've been talking about a new report that outlines a series of policy options the CRC is recommending to the legislature to support kids from birth to age 3. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
It's Current State on WKAR. We're always eager to hear your thoughts and suggestions for our program. Our email address, currentstate@wkar.org. Michigan is not among the first states that come to mind when you mention the aerospace industry. An amateur rocket launch scheduled for Saturday in southwest Michigan is unlikely to change that. On Saturday afternoon, members of a Michiana rocketry club plan to blast a porta potty into space near the community of Three Oaks, near the Indiana state line. Curious to learn more, I spoke yesterday with Larry Kingman, one of a group of rocket enthusiasts who've dubbed themselves the Throne Thrusters. I first asked Mr. Kingman how far off the ground the porta potty is likely to soar.
We're anticipating in the neighborhood of 2,500 feet, which is, I guess, about the equivalent of twice the height of the Empire State Building, just to give somebody a visual comparison.
How did the idea of sending up a porta potty, of all things, get started?
There's a local high-power rocketry club. We have Michiana Rocketry that flies out of a field in Three Oaks every winter. And in at the last launch of the 2011-2012 season, the volunteers that were putting stuff away were just kind of standing around reminiscing over the season because it was going to be not until fall that we were able to launch again. And one of the guys is the owner of a local hobby store, and he pointed at the dilapidated porta potty that we have out in the field there for our use and said, if somebody wants to make a rocket out of one of those, I'll put the motors in it. And everybody present immediately chimed in and said they would be happy to be a part of that project.
Couldn't say no to that.
Absolutely not.
What are you using exactly to get this craft off the ground? What kind of engine? What kind of fuel?
The power for the rocket will actually be a cluster of 7 motors. In the high-power rocketry hobby, we use ammonium perchlorate-based solid propellant. So there will be a total of 7 motors with an average thrust of about 1,800 pounds, or about equal to that of a mid-sized car, Toyota Corolla or something like that.
Some of our listeners are wondering if this is nothing more than a publicity stunt or if you're actually studying something on this mission. Are you?
Well, it is not purely a publicity stunt, although we are hoping to use the media visibility to help heighten awareness in general about the high-power rocketry hobby as a whole. The thing with odd rockets, odd-shaped designs, is that there is just a higher-than-average challenge to design and build and launch a vehicle that is stable in flight than with a conventional design.
Are you expecting onlookers?
We are expecting quite a lot of spectators. There's been pretty good media representation, so we will have the site prepared and marked out. We have maps available, et cetera. So, yes, we're expecting spectators, and spectators are welcome.
Seriously, what safety precautions do you take when you send something up? I mean, there's fuel involved, there's fire.
There's a number of safety precautions that we do. We have to have clear skies, and we have to have calm winds because we have to verify that we're launching into an unoccupied airspace. We have fire extinguishers and people prepared in case there's a fire started on the ground to put that out, although we're out in a harvested soybean field, so there's not a lot of stuff to catch on fire. And then there's also a safety code written by the National Fire Protection Association regarding high-power rockets. And so based on the sizes of the motors, there are certain distances that we set the rockets back from the closest person. So in this case, the safe setback distance for this rocket will be 2,000 feet.
And what precautions are you taking regarding re-entry? I mean, the craft will be blazing back to Earth here.
Yes, the rocket is designed to come back down on two 26-foot skydiving parachutes, so the descent rate actually should be less than 40 feet per second. So the descent rate should be controlled and slow so that it's not going to be crashing to Earth as it would without them. And there are electronics on board to control when the parachutes are deployed. So by design, the rocket should go up to its point of apogee, which is where it arcs over and comes back down, and then the parachute should come out there and bring it down relatively close to the launch pad and at a safe speed.
That will be a sight to behold.
That is a fact.
very little chance of burning up on re-entry, though, from that altitude.
No, we won't have those kinds of speeds.
No. What other kinds of craft does the Michiana Rocketry Club launch?
The club that launches out of that field, we have members everywhere from youngsters that launch small Class 1 models, rockets like Estes models that you can buy at Hobby Lobby or any other local store, all the way up through men and women of all ages that are launching high-power rockets up to, this will be actually equivalent to a Complex O motor size, and once again, that may not mean much to most people, but it's basically the largest that you can fly without approaching the commercial space program.
Hmm. Well, Larry Kingman is a member of the Michiana Rocketry Club. Saturday near Three Oaks, Michigan, Larry and some other members will be launching a porta potty into the far lower atmosphere. Good luck, Larry. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, political newcomer Tom Barrett narrowly defeated incumbent Teresa Abbott to claim Michigan's 71st House District seat. We'll talk with the incoming freshman Republican. That and more Friday on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Glad you could join us. It's Current State on WKAR.